Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
The material is just thin, in my judgment. And so, given how hard ancient history is in general, I think that there are skeptical scenarios that work if you are a skeptic. I'm not a skeptic, but I'm trying to be fair-minded and objective. I also happen to think, as I told you, I'm a Christian. I'm happy to say Jesus rose from the dead. But I don't think I can persuade a totally open-minded person on the basis of history alone. That just isn't the way it works. Do you believe in hell? 'Cause I am helpless. This water I am treading is now my own.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and welcome back to part two of my conversation with Dr. Dale Allison. And I know it's a little weird in terms of release schedule, but thank you so much for joining and listening. This is, again, part two of my conversation about resurrection specifically. And I was very grateful to have Dr. Allison on to talk about his work on that very subject, and wanted to get both parts out before Easter. And so here you are. With part two. So if you haven't listened to part one yet, pause this one, go back to last week, listen to the first part, and then come back and listen to this part. If you've already heard it, then you're in the right place. Other than that, the usual stuff, if you've been listening for a while, you know, go to the website, www.thedeconstructionist.com. Everything you can possibly imagine related to the podcast is on there. All sorts of new Patreon, what do they call them? Packages, I guess, I don't know, are on the website, including swag with international shipping, which is not something that we were able to offer before. So now we have some international options on there. So if you've always wanted something with our big logo on it, you can have it. And then other than that, the blog is on there. I've been writing a lot more lately. In fact, early unedited blog posts and unedited versions of these episodes in their entirety go up on the Patreon first. So if you want to check that out, plenty of content coming. And yeah, anyway, appreciate your support and thank you for listening. Without further ado, here's part two and the final episode with Dr. Dale freaking Allison. Do you believe in hell? 'Cause I am helpless. This water I am treading. Matters most as the lights go out and a swing. Yeah, I find that to be really interesting. And from a historical standpoint, when I'm trying to look at sources and get as many primary sources, folks that were as close to Jesus as possible, who may have been firsthand witnesses, then it sort of throws into doubt if we don't know who wrote them and if it maybe wasn't, you know, the author it's attributed to, aka a disciple who was present at the time. Then it makes you wonder, well, was this something that was written by a school of followers who didn't have a firsthand account and were just kind of writing down what they had heard, you know? So it kind of starts to sort of strain the resources that we do have.
Yeah. And we also, so if you have a court, the judge wants the witnesses to be independent. And the judge means by that, if there were witnesses at the scene of the crime, the judge wants it so that they haven't talked to each other since that moment, right? They went their separate ways, and you know, you don't want people to be contaminated. But the disciples are talking to each other from the beginning, I'm sure. Whenever anything weird happened, they must have said, what the heck was that? Did you see that? What does it mean? How do we interpret it? That must be going on from the beginning. But beyond that, the literary question is not now for me what it used to be. So I used to think the Gospel of John is independent of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I no longer think that. I actually think that the Gospel of John shows knowledge of Luke. I think it shows knowledge of Matthew, probably of Mark. Now, it still has independent traditions, but it's not an independent voice in my mind anymore, right? And if you look, for example, at Luke and Mark, whoever the author of Luke is, he seems to be using Mark. And this is interesting. If you were to accept the traditional conservative view that Mark wrote Mark and Luke wrote Luke, they both know Paul and they both know each other because they're mentioned together in a couple of places in the New Testament. So even if you accept that these are the people, you know, that tradition says they are, they must be talking to each other. So they're not separate, independent witnesses. So I don't know that in any case we have independent witnesses to anything, at least in the modern sense that you want for a trial with two people who heard Jesus utter a sentence and then they went their separate ways, never talked to each other, and what they reported got written up in two different literary texts. I don't know that we have that at any point, which is another problem, right?
Yeah. Now, one of the other things I'd be interested to know, too, is one of the other things that I would look at would be, you know, because the further along we go, more scholars seem to think that, look, a lot of our old stories were more metaphor than historical fact, and oftentimes borrowed from older traditions, you know, baby Moses in the basket of reeds, you know, mm-hmm. kind of borrowed from earlier traditions and so on. So, is there any evidence to suggest that there were other resurrected messiahs, you know, within other cultures?
Well, so if you're asking the question, are there Greek and Roman stories in which people's bodies go missing, right? Mm-hmm. Then yes, Romulus, for example, or Hercules. Or stories also in which these people reappear after they die. Yes, there are such stories. And I think if you take the Greco-Roman stories and put them all together, they're probably the best argument against there being historically an empty tomb. That seems to me to be obvious. On the other hand, we also know, because we know a lot about, or we know some things about tomb robbery in the ancient world, we actually do know that some tombs were emptied and some bodies were gone, and it was something that happened, right? So just because you have legends about something doesn't mean everything is a legend. And the other thing is that this gets really, really complicated, at least for somebody like me. So if you look at the transfiguration of Jesus, we'll move from resurrection to transfiguration for just a second. So this looks to me like it echoes the story of Moses. Moses is the guy on the Old Testament who goes up on a mountain. And when he's there, he glows. And there's a cloud that comes down. And God's voice comes from the cloud. And this happens after 6 days, as it does in Mark 9. And Moses himself appears in the story, right? So you can look at any number of things here, and you can say, as some scholars have, well, Christians just made this up because they wanted Jesus to be at least as great as Moses or greater than Moses, so he has to do the miracles like Moses, or at least some of them. But here's where it becomes difficult for me, and this is actually where I lose all my audience, okay? Almost all my audience. People don't like this on the right or left. But as an historian, I actually think that the evidence for people seeing glowing people is rather robust. I think it's pretty good. So I actually know two people. How many people in world history do I know? Not that many. The percentage of people who have lived that I know, it's really, really tiny, right? Two of them have told me that they saw somebody glow. One was a Sufi master, and one was a Tibetan Buddhist master. Well, one of these individuals is my own son. And he saw this with three other people who all got together afterwards and said, did you see that? Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so what do I do with this? All right, I just say, okay, I think this happens. And by the way, Roman Catholic canonization records are full of this, full of people swearing they saw Teresa of Avila and dozens of others glowing. So I look at the Gospels and I say, well, you know, if you want to say that this is a made-up event or a legend on the basis of Moses, I can't disprove that. On the other hand, I have the weird view that people sometimes have visions of religious figures glowing, whatever the explanation may be. And so I think it's possible in theory that a disciple or even some disciples had a vision of Jesus. And I think if they had had a vision of him glowing, they would have thought, oh, this is like Moses. And they would have written up the story with echoes of the story of Moses in it, right? The problem is that there are also just legends of glowing people. There are legends of glowing people, stories that nobody takes seriously. So we know they can be legends. This issue of legend and history is really difficult. Or again, just take one other quick example. I think Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist. But I think there is some theological overlay here. I think the Christians have probably added the voice from heaven, right? And the declaration that this is my beloved son. And I think Matthew has added a conversation between Jesus and John where John says, hey, you know, it ought to be the other way around, right? And Jesus says, no, it's okay. Go ahead. So I think there's an historical event there. But I think it has been overlaid. And I think that is the case, myself, with the story of the empty tomb and much that we find in the gospel. So I think that some stories are purely legendary. I don't believe in the guards at the tomb, for example. I don't think the dead got up in Matthew 27 when Jesus died. There was an earthquake and the tombs were emptied and they went into Jerusalem. I don't think that literally happened. Nonetheless, I still think there was probably, not certainly, but probably a story of Jesus' tomb being empty that circulated really early on. And I would attribute it to the original story to women. I think historically some women went up to Jerusalem from Galilee with Jesus. And I think some of them probably witnessed his crucifixion, which was a public event. That's what you do when you have malefactors, when you have people who break the law. You want to show in public, don't do this, because you'll end up like this person. So crucifixions are at crossroads. They're public places. So some of Jesus's followers, I'm sure, were there to see it, as the Gospels actually say. And then if there were some people who were there, they probably would have followed the body wherever it went. And it's also natural for people to go to graves or to tombs, especially soon after a death. It's just what everybody does in every society that I know of. So I just think if a group of women actually went up with Jesus to Jerusalem and watched him die, that the other things are actually sort of expected. Of course, they would have some idea where he was buried, and they would go back later for some reason, just to whether they wanted to add to the burial, maybe not. Maybe they just went to mourn like we all do at graves, right? So I think it's historical, but I think the speech of the angel has to be Christian overlay. I think the guards in Matthew are overlay. I think the Gospel of John adding the beloved disciple to the scene and so on. So the way I like to put it is I think there's a gist memory here that is the basic point is there. Jesus was buried, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15. He wasn't left on the cross. And he wasn't thrown in a pile. And then early on, there's a story of his tomb being empty.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think we see this even with more modern history where, you know, as they say, that the quote goes, you know, the victors, you know, write the history, you know, so it's always sort of tainted in some way, you know, or you know, kind of written in a more glorious way than perhaps it actually happened. One of the interesting things too is, and maybe you could talk a little bit about this, is typically when, because there are other prophets and Messiah figures of the time who had followers and were killed, and that typically was kind of the end of it. You know, they would kind of disperse, you know, and so on. So what was different about this situation? Because there is a moment in scripture where you see the, you know, two of the disciples were heading away from the city and heading to Emmaus and seemed to think that, well, that's done, you know?
Yeah.
So, but something changed their minds, right? So what was it that kept this movement of Christianity going?
So here is my own take on this. I think there are three main ingredients to the Easter faith. So first of all, I think Luke 19 is correct when it says that the disciples went up to Jerusalem expecting the kingdom of God to appear immediately or soon. My own view is that Jesus had a near expectation, was hoping that things would wrap up sooner than later, and at points was probably hoping that things were very near, right? So I think the disciples live with that expectation. And if you're one of Jesus' disciples, you're going to think, like the Pharisees did, that when the end comes, or when the Messiah comes, or when the kingdom comes, among other things, the dead will be raised, as the book of Daniel, for example, says, right? So I think they are hoping for the resurrection of the dead during the ministry of Jesus. So if then, within that context of expectation, of hope for the general resurrection of the dead, not Jesus' resurrection, I mean the resurrection of the dead. If that's the context, and in that context, there's a story of his tomb being emptied, right? Okay. Now, of course, that by itself isn't going to do anything because tombs were robbed and so on. But if you have that, plus the testimony of one or two people you trust that, hey, I've seen Jesus, I think if you put 1 + 2 + 3 together, you're going to get what you have here. So that's my own take on it. You have the story of an empty tomb. You have appearances. You have people saying, I saw him, right? And then you have this expectation, which gives you the interpretive category. Oh, I know what this must be. This must be the resurrection of the dead. By the way, the early Christians, in my judgment, don't think of the resurrection of Jesus as an isolated event. That is, they think that it's the first fruits. He's the first fruits, as 1 Corinthians 15 says. And if you have the first fruits, well, the rest comes real soon. I mean, once the first fruits are gone, you know, the harvest follows immediately. There's no time between the two. And so Jesus is the first fruits. Or in Matthew 28, you have the story, 27, of these other people rising from the dead, which makes it more of a collective event, right? And then you have in some of these letters attributed to Paul, you get the idea that Christians have actually already risen. They've died and they've been raised with Christ. So it's very interesting. It's not just Jesus's resurrection and that's it. There's some sense that this is part of a larger collective thing going on, which is what you have in Judaism, where the resurrection is universal. It's at the end and so on. So I think early Christians think that Jesus's resurrection is the beginning of the resurrection of the dead, or the inauguration or start, or just the beginning of things. But anyway, I think the category is given with the expectations that they have before Easter and before Good Friday. And by the way, that makes perfect sense, because the first Christians, the first disciples, the first Christ followers are people who knew the historical Jesus and regarded him as a teacher and were following him around and were listening to him. And I think their categories, their ideas would be derived from him. So it makes perfect sense. He's presented in the Gospels, in Mark 12, for example, as defending the belief in the resurrection of the dead, right? And I personally don't think his disciples from the very beginning would have said, hey, let's use this resurrection concept, if they didn't already have it to hand, right? I think it was given to them by their tradition and reinforced by Jesus himself.
Save big money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth, so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP lawn and garden and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big money at
Menards. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, I think that's one of the most fascinating aspects of our resurrection story within Christianity, is just the reaction of the disciples after that. But you're right. It would be fascinating to know, to have more of the actual first person writings from all of these disciples and say, oh, what was life like after that? You know, but it did seem to in some way invigorate them to continue to spread the gospel. Or at least on Paul, you know, Paul certainly had a large hand in it.
So I think you can make the argument that if the tomb hadn't been empty, or we didn't have a story of that, and if nobody had said, I've seen Jesus alive, right, I doubt that we would have had Christianity. Maybe we would have something, I don't know what. I think there's evidence, for example, that the followers of John the Baptist, or at least some of them, continued to be Baptists on into the second century. I think there's enough evidence of that. And John was martyred. And I don't know, maybe somebody thought that he rose from the dead. You know, in Mark 6, you have that bizarre passage about, well, maybe Jesus is John the Baptist risen from the dead, which is attributed to Herod Antipas. I've never known quite what to make of that weird comment, and I don't know whether it represents anything other than a very idiosyncratic opinion. But I do think that John was martyred and that he continued to have followers. So maybe there would have been people who, you know, remember Jesus as a great teacher, something like that. But you wouldn't have had what you have, which is this version of Christianity which puts death and resurrection at the center of everything. You wouldn't have Pauline Christianity. You wouldn't have the Gospel of Mark. You just wouldn't have that.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable. You wouldn't think that unless something significant had happened that these individuals would literally put their lives at risk continuing to preach this message unless they truly, you know, believed it.
So that's the old argument from martyrdom, which some apologists use to defend the resurrection. And I think it works for Paul. I think it works for Peter. It works for James, the son of Zebedee, who, according to to Acts, was martyred sometime in the 40s. So I think, yeah, you can say that's a decent argument for their sincerity. But as soon as you say that, you have to add that you don't really know anything about most of the people on the list of the 12. You have later legends, but I've never been convinced that there's much history in those legends. So some people say, for example, that there's enough evidence for us to think that Thomas made it to India. If you've ever known any Indian Christians, a number of them think they are descended from Thomas, who went to India and converted Indians long, long, long ago. That's possible, but Thaddeus, Bartholomew, Matthew, I don't know anything about these characters, and I don't think anyone else does. There are stories about their martyrdoms, right? There are stories about their martyrdoms, but that doesn't surprise me. I don't know why it's not obvious to everybody, but at the beginning of Acts 1, Jesus says, "You will be my witnesses," you know, to the 12, right? And the Greek word for witness is martyr there, and it means witnesses. The word martyr means witness, right? But I am sure early Christians read this to mean Jesus was predicting that they would all be martyred. So, of course, we have stories about all of them being martyred. Of course we do. Jesus prophesied it, and that's going to guarantee it. But I don't see any reason to believe these stories. When I was working on the Gospel of Matthew many years ago, I looked at all the different legends about Matthew, and they had nothing in common. It was just obvious people were guessing and making things up, and there wasn't anything there. So it gets back to the thinness of the sources, right? Yeah, I'd love to see Matthew's diary. Wouldn't that be great?
Yes.
And by the way, it's also weird to think, isn't it, that if we had Bartholomew's diary and Thaddeus's diary and Matthew's diary, that there would be no surprises?
We'd still be talking.
No way.
Yeah.
There would be surprises. What they would be, I don't know, but they would be there.
Absolutely. We'd still be having conversations like this. I have no doubt.
Yeah, that's correct.
So what is your, because I realize we're coming up on our time here. What is your personal, after all this research, you spent all this time on it, you come at it from a historian's perspective. You've looked at what evidence we do have. Did any of the other texts that aren't included in the Bible, any of those come into play? Because I know a lot of scholars feel like, we can't really take them too seriously because most of them were written way, way after the fact. What was your personal conclusion when you got to the end of it?
What you mean about other sources, extra canonical sources?
Sure.
They don't play any role in my historical decisions. So the Gospel of Peter, at one time, I argued might be independent of Matthew, and I thought it might contain some early traditions. I think it's still possible that at one or two points it does, but for the most part, I think it's a legendary secondary work. And if you go mining for history there, you might find one little tiny piece of gold, maybe. It looks to me, we don't know because the text is fragmentary, it looks to me that the Gospel of Peter might have presented an appearance at the Sea of Galilee as the first appearance to the disciples, which is what some people have conjectured for John 21, John 21, which looks to many of us like a secondary or late edition of the text. But the idea is that Jesus appears to Peter and the disciples, and they've gone back to fishing. And it is kind of weird. It's like, what are they doing? The appearance on the Sea of Galilee in John 21 has impressed some as being maybe a remnant of the first appearance in Galilee. Very different than Matthew's story in Matthew 28. Maybe it was, in which case the Gospel of Peter might have had that sequence. It might have had the disciples going back to Galilee not having seen Jesus, and the first appearance being something by the Sea of Galilee. But other than that, no, there's a story about the appearance of James. I think it's late secondary. I don't see any history in it, so I don't see anything to help us here. It would be nice if there were, but there just isn't. So we're stuck with the New Testament sources, which are in fact the earliest sources for belief about the resurrection.
So based on the sources that we do have, you know, after you did all of your research and looked into them and kind of try to weigh the pros and cons to either side of the aisle, what was your personal conclusion at the end of all of this?
Well, I say that my personal conclusions within my academic context are actually antediluvian. But by that, I mean really conservative. So I decided that Jesus was buried and buried by somebody named Joseph of Arimathea. I'm not sure of his motive. I'm not sure what's going on, but I think there's a memory there. I also think the tomb was found empty by Mary Magdalene and probably some other women also. I think that there was probably an early appearance to Mary Magdalene. And those are very conservative opinions within the guild, right? They put me on the side of the apologists. And I think that the early Christians believed that Jesus had appeared to Peter and to the 12. And I would guess that the 12 believed this also. It's an interesting question. How do you explain a collective vision or a collective encounter? Again, that's one of the points that the apologists like to bring up time after time. And the 500, you know, if 500 people at the same time thought they saw Jesus, isn't that evidential? So I think there were at least two group appearances, and then there were some appearances to individuals. I'm sure there were more appearances than we have reference to, but you only record the appearances of important people, you know, people who have some power and sway and influence and who are known to a wider audience. If Jesus had appeared to some unknown widow, right, in some small village, we just wouldn't know about that, right? I'd be happy to learn that, but
yeah.
it's not in the sources. So my conclusions were conservative, but they didn't lead me to say, oh, the apologists are right, and you have to be very stupid not to look at the evidence and say, okay, Jesus rose from the dead. I don't think that's the case.
I like that. We try to talk a lot about on this podcast about the idea of becoming more at peace with ambiguity and uncertainty. I think, you know, too often this desire for certainty kind of leads us down the wrong path too often. And, you know, when we're talking about the divine, you know, God, this mysterious other, you know, oftentimes we have to just kind of throw up our hands and say, well, this is our best guess, but we really don't know. And so I think part of our journey together as both me as the host and the listeners out there is kind of becoming more comfortable, with uncertainty. So I kind of like the idea that your conclusion could go both ways, you know, and some of the story could be absolutely true and some of it could be some embellishment later, but, it can be both.
Well, obviously, I'm fine with that. I don't know the psychology involved here. I do know lots of people who want certainty or are anxious about it. I just am not like that. I have no idea why. You know, maybe it has something to do with my mother. I can't tell you. It's just never bothered me. And I've also always thought that the world is big. And we can't fathom even the physical universe. If there is an invisible spiritual universe, or if there are other dimensions or other realities that sometimes intersect with ours, we have no hope of figuring things out. And actually, I could add, one of the things I did in the book is I said, you know, at this point in time, I've read enough books written by physicists to know that I have no idea anymore what matter is. I really don't. I don't know what matter is. I don't know what energy is. I think there must be something analogous to a soul, but I don't know ontologically or metaphysically what the heck it is. I don't know how it relates to our brain. And so, I just don't get much of anything. So given that, you have to be humble. You also have to be humble when you realize that there are really intelligent, good-hearted people who disagree with you about almost everything, right?
Yeah.
The idea that I have everything, if I have everything figured out, what it means is everybody else is wrong. And the odds of that are zero.
Yeah.
The odds of that are zero.
Absolutely.
So, you know, to use Christian language here, at the end of the day, you have to throw yourself back on the language of mystery and also use the language of grace, right? If anybody understands that we can't figure things out, it must be God, right? God must understand that we can't figure everything out. Or God must understand that we often make honest mistakes. People make honest mistakes. So you just do your best and you have hope and faith.
I love it. That's a great place to end, I think. So thank you so much. This is a fascinating conversation. I really think the listener is going to love it. Happy Easter to everyone listening. And thanks again for giving me some of your time. I know you're busy right now.
Thanks for having me, John.
slow.